Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to see you all come today and practice dying into each moment, right? Because that's what we do. We practice dying into each moment and being present with each moment. And then when our final breath comes, we've been practicing our whole lives with this moment. One teacher said that one way to think about death is it's a gift that we're required to give for the joy of our life. And I thought that was a nice way to say it. And even though we don't necessarily want to give it, we can give it with some sense of generosity. You know, it's a gift to our children, it's a gift to people around us, and it's a gift to the universe. You know, it's a gift to the trees and the plants, and we don't know what the universe is going to do with it, but we can trust that it's done a pretty good job up to this point. Recycling. Part of the big recycling plan. Sigurosh used to say, you know, it's a little like, I think about it, we don't, those of us that have kids, we don't want our kids to grow up. You know, you just, it's hard, it's kind of painful to have your kids grow up until they get to be teenagers, right? Then it gets to be a lot easier. But you don't want your kids to grow up, but it'd be a big problem if your kids didn't grow up, right? And so you both have that sense of regret, but you also, there's some part of you that really understands. And you also, there's a part of you that really understands what a big problem would be is if we lived forever, right? Mm-hmm. That would be a big problem, you know, for everybody, including us. So it is a gift, you know, and we can learn how to give it up. So I wanted to read the Heart Sutra because our practice has a lot to do with our meditation practice. Is the best practice we can have, I think, for letting go. Because each breath, we're letting go. So I'd really encourage you today to take up that mantra. Really say very softly to yourself, let go. When you have a thought, you're lost and you're thinking, let go. Just let go. Practice letting go and just coming back to that spaciousness. Let go. Thought after thought, breath after breath, come back to that spaciousness. So today, maybe as we go through the day, I'll try to do some readings and things that will encourage us. Do you remember seeing that movie, Kundun, with Scorsese, where somebody died at the end? And the Tuchel, it's been a while, but in the back they were chanting, and in the back what they were chanting was the Heart Sutra. Mm. And they were chanting it in Sanskrit. In a funeral ceremony, the two texts that are chanted at the memorial service are the Heart Sutra and the one called the Dahi Shindrani, which I'm gonna chant for you in a few minutes. But I thought, because we do chant this, the Heart Sutra, we chant it frequently, that this is such a refuge for us. Because what is happening here is Avalokiteshvara, the great Bodhisattva of compassion, is disseminating this teaching. The Buddha turns and says, please disseminate the teaching on compassion and how to alleviate fear. And the first sentence really says it. This Bodhisattva, who's practicing deeply Prajnaparamita, who's practicing exactly what we're practicing this meditation, which is beyond our small self, but includes our small self, when practicing the Prajnaparamita, clearly saw that all five aggregates are empty and thus relieved all suffering. That's it, the first sentence. The aggregates are everything that make us up. Our emotions, our feelings, our sensations, our perceptions, our memories. saw that these, none of these are concrete. They all are fleeting. They all are impermanent. And if we observe this in our meditation and deepen our insight into this, that this is an ephemeral process, and we're constantly letting go, whether we're aware of it or not. And in this process of deeply understanding that letting go of every sensation that arises, all fear is alleviated by deeply penetrating this insight. And then the rest of the sutra goes ahead and just reinforces what that first sentence says. Shariputra, who was one of Buddha's main, most intelligent disciples, kind of all volumes, Shariputra, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. So in this very form, we find emptiness. In all form, we find emptiness. We find the absolute. We find the sense of impermanence, the sense of everything flowing into everything else. Form itself is emptiness, emptiness itself form. Sensations, perceptions, formations, and consciousness, what we just said before, are also like this. They all flow into one another. Shariputra, all dharmas, everything, is marked by emptiness, by not being able to hang on to anything. Everything arises and disappears. They neither arise nor cease, are neither defiled nor pure, neither increase nor decrease. Well, we think things decrease, but they're saying here that things neither increase or decrease. So when we die, our elements, we're still here, we're just not in the same form that we were before we died. Therefore, given emptiness, there is no form, no sensations, no perceptions, no formations, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no sight, no sound, no smell. Well, of course there are all these things, but what he's saying is that none of these things stand alone. They're all dependent and interrelated with one another. No realm of sight, no realm of mind consciousness. And then the next sentence, there is neither ignorance nor extinction of ignorance. And the sentence that I like is, there is neither old age nor death, nor extinction of old age and death. So yeah, there is. This particular body, we'll have to give it up as a gift. But there will also be no extinction of it, right? Because what made us up existed before it took this particular incarnation, and it will exist after, because we know that all elements do not just disappear. So when we reflect deeply on that, there is some sense of satisfaction in that. As Thich Nhat Hanh says, you don't really, have to worry as long as you're not too concerned about, maybe turning into a leaf or a tree. Now, I should say that, my training is in the Zen tradition, and the two kind of streams in terms of looking at death and dying, there's kind of the sort of Zen stream way of looking at it in the Mahayana tradition and the Tibetan. And the Tibetan tradition comes down very solidly behind the idea of reincarnation. I don't know if reincarnation exists or not. Some of you may have a very deep feeling that it does exist, and I would encourage you to look and explore Stephen Batchelor's book called Buddhism Without Belief, where the book actually, there's a dialogue between Robert Thurman, who's a professor of Tibetan studies at Columbia, and he comes down on the side, a very learned man, as the Dalai Lama does, believing that the belief in incarnation is actually quite important and real. Or Stephen Batchelor, which I'm actually, my own sense is that it's never been proven to him that it exists, and so he holds it as a mystery. What we do know is that we do incarnate moment to moment, and we also know that whatever thoughts or karma that we've created in our life, that exists beyond us, not only our physical elements, but our mental elements. So that's a gift that we give too, is how we've led our life to our children, to our friends, and how that permeates out into the universe. So when we look from the Tibetan perspective, they put a very strong emphasis on the last moments of death, the last moments, because the last moment you have, the clarity of that moment is what propels you on to your next birth. Whereas one scholar explained to me in person once, Jim Blofeld, he said it's kind of like a flame flickering. You think the flame is a continual flame, but actually it's a flickering flame. And then it gets to the moment of your death, and the flame continues to flicker on the other side, but this flame is different than this flame, just like this flame is different than that flame, and that flame is different. And if you think about that as a continuity, so in the Tibetan tradition, that continuity of how you think propels you into your next birth. And that has serious implications because, for example, they believe that in this room right now, we were all related, probably in a prior incarnation. So since you were probably my mother or my sister, you know, in prior incarnation, I really should treat you with a great deal of respect and appreciation and gratitude. So that's a very deep part of their practice. But even in the Zen tradition, we hold it more as kind of a mystery. And certainly the way Zen is practiced more in a contemporary way, is we don't really know. We hold it as, we know that we don't end, there's something that continues, but we don't actually know what that is. So, but what we do know is that how you lead your life moment to moment will affect the next moment of how you lead your life. So if you lead your life with the kind of calmness and clarity and mental discipline where you're cultivating positive states of mind, healthy states of mind, that your next incarnation, whether it's a second from now or a minute from now, will be more advantageous. And so if there is incarnation beyond this existence into a physical form or an animal form or whatever, it's going to be more advantageous. So the work is the same as we lead our life with a sense of integrity and a sense of calmness. In the Tibetan tradition, actually, traditionally, it was so important at the end. The end was so important that family members actually weren't allowed when somebody was dying, because the idea being is that not wanting to let your loved ones go would pull them back, and you don't want that kind of energy. The kind of energy you want in the room with a person that's dying is a sense of relief, a sense of letting them go, of moving them into the ocean of great expansive ocean of oneness. You don't want to be pulling them back with sorrow and grief and, no, I can't leave. And that actually is what happens often. You know, because I ran a hospice for a long time. In the dying process, often people can't go, and what's very important is that you actually can give the person permission to go. Either you don't have to say anything, but just let them understand that this is a natural process, and that the grief has a lot to do more with your own need than what their need is, which is to let go. And that's a big process for families to come to have an understanding what that's about. Maybe I thought I'd read, there's a few chapters in Suzuki Roshi that really kind of help us understand what this letting go, this moment-to-moment letting go is really about. First practice, he's talking about calmness of mind. First practice smoothly exhaling, then inhaling. Calmness of mind is beyond the end of your exhale. If you exhale smoothly, without even trying to exhale, you are entering into the complete, perfect calmness of your mind. You do not exist anymore. When you inhale, when you exhale this way, then naturally your inhalation will start from there. All that fresh blood bringing everything from the outside will pervade your body. You are completely refreshed. Then you start to exhale to extend that fresh feeling into emptiness. So moment after moment, without trying to do anything, you continue this kind of meditation. In ours, called Shikantaza. So I often think of it as the inhale is more in the realm of form, and the exhale is the more in the realm of emptiness, form and emptiness. You kind of reify in the inhale, and on the exhale, you're letting go into emptiness. Inhaling without effort, you naturally come back to yourself with some color or form. Exhaling, you gradually fade into emptiness. Empty, white paper. That is Shikantaza. The important point is your exhalation. Instead of trying to feel yourself as you inhale, fade into emptiness as you exhale. And it's a very tangible feeling that you'll have, and you'll see, like when Dogen, who is the one that brought this form of meditation, when he went to his teacher Ru Jing, he said, "I have dropped body and mind." So that doesn't mean that he didn't have any sensation in his body, or his mind still wasn't operating, or he couldn't think when he wanted to think. But he got beyond that. He saw that he was more than just his body sensations and his thinking process. I've dropped body and mind. And that's what that means. And you can actually have a physical, palpable sensation of that in your meditation practice. When you practice this in your last moment, you will have nothing to be afraid of. If you practice this during your life, you will have nothing to be afraid of. You are actually aiming at emptiness. You become one with everything after you completely exhale with this feeling. If you are still alive, naturally you will inhale again. If you feel like that. Oh, I'm alive. Fortunately or unfortunately, he says here, this is great, a sense of humor. Then you start to exhale and fade into emptiness. Maybe you don't know what kind of feeling it is, but some of you know it. By some chance you have had this kind of felt sense of this feeling. When you do this practice, you cannot become easily angry when you are more interested in inhaling than you're exhaling. You easily become angry. You know what he's saying here? In other words, the inhale is more like reifying yourself, you know, coming into form. Me, mine, that's the metaphor, what I want. Exhaling is letting go. Letting go into this emptiness. You're always trying to be alive. In other words, you're fighting, you're hanging on. So our practice, we used to say in hospice a lot, I would say people usually die the way they live. So if your life tends to be one that has a lot of control, that you need to control a lot, you know, and you're pretty rigid, then that's probably the way you'll die. There's lots of exceptions to that, but if you can practice letting go, letting go, letting go, then the chances are that when you come time to die, you'll be able to let go. So that's a great chapter. This is Tsukiroshi's second book, and his first book was Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. So, you know, in Japan, Zen priests were the guys that do funerals. And if you get married, you go to a Shinto priest. And is Anne still here?
Yeah.
That's right, Anne, right?
Right.
Yeah, you go to a Shinto because it's kind of like, and us Zen guys, because we practice letting go a lot, well, we can help you let go. So we tend to do that. In fact, it started, you know, in Tang Dynasty, where these Zen teachers were trying to tell people there wasn't any fear in this thing about you're just letting go into the next. Who is it? Wayne Dreyer. I just read it in the paper the other day. It was great. You know, Wayne Dreyer's a guy that wrote all these self-help books, you know. And did you read his obituary? And they said, no, it's okay. He says, I'm just looking forward to the next adventure. And I don't know if you went to see Timothy Leary's. There was a, I thought, quite a wonderful documentary on Leary and Albert at the Rio. I really appreciated it. And that's just came up with him, you know, about his idea about, well, it's just the next adventure. I don't know what the adventure will be. Might not even have this kind of consciousness to appreciate it, but I know there's going to be the next adventure. So, when I became ordained, that was kind of part of the curriculum, was to explore this, to really kind of look at what death and dying was. And even before I became ordained, I remember reading Carlos Castaneda's Don Juan books. Anybody here read Don Juan's books? They were actually pretty great. And one of the things you remember in Don Juan, he said, Don Juan is saying to Carlos, he says, death is your ally. Use death as your ally. And I had one of my mentors was a Benedictine monk named Brother David Stanaras, and I asked him, what's your definition of a monk or a spiritual person? He says, a monk is somebody who lives with death on their shoulder. And then I kept reading, very interesting, you know, I read about this tribe, and I think it was New Guinea or up in the mountains of Laos. And when you get to be a certain age, you fit yourself out, you build yourself a coffin, and then you prop the coffin up outside the door of your house. So every time you go into your house, you see your coffin. And this goes on for, you know, a number of years while you're still walking around. So there's that memory all the time. So how can death be your ally? How could death be actually a friend while you're living? The knowledge, or to, instead of like what most of us do, which we know is actually the great denial, Doug Hammarskjöld used to say, you know, remember he used to be the Secretary General of the UN, a very spiritual man. He'd say, when I was a young person, death was just something in the crowd. And I can remember that. When I was young, I'd say, why does anybody ever worry about death? And then he says, but the older I get, now it's at the dinner table with me every night. And that's true. When you start to get to be around my age, you start to see how many people are dying that are younger than you or your age. You can't ignore it anymore. It's harder to be in denial. So maybe that's why you're here today, is because you know that you can't be in denial, that you need to kind of look at it. So how, I ask you that. How can death be your ally during your life if you really actually use it and reflect on it?
Well, yeah. I see that the time I have ahead is much less than what I've already done. And therefore, how I look at my life and what activities I'm going to be doing, I really think, do I need to go to another rock and roll concert, or am I going to read this sutra that was other classic book that I've never read that's on the shelf? So it makes it clearer for me, my choices.
Yeah, that's
maybe
exactly
wise choices now.
It's exactly right. And when we study the Lojong teachings, which we've been doing, Kathy and some of us here, the very first slogan is the preliminaries. Study the preliminaries. And the preliminary is get your priorities straight. What is really important in your life? And as we get older, we realize that, you know, fame and fortune has eluded us at this point. It's probably not going to happen, right? To the degree we thought maybe it was at one point. Or wealth. I got enough. I'm clearly not going to make a lot more money. Anyway, that drops away. It begins to drop away, and you begin to set your priorities. What is really important? And so, hopefully the conclusion we come to is your spiritual practice, your journey, your path, you know, is most important. And what is the path? Well, what else comes up for people when I said that? How else can it be your ally? What is your priorities, Steve?
Well, I found it to to be an ally in the sense of, more like a Camus would say, that if this is alliance with the, what Patty said, is that if this is what we have, then it needs to be something of significance, to live a significant life. And that's steered me for a long time.
Yeah. So again, kind of a priority. And the tangible manifestation of that is, well, you're much more intentional how you lead your life. You're much more conscious about your karma, how what your effects are with other people. You're much more aware about how you treat people. If I know that I'm not going to see my wife tomorrow, I'm not going to speak as harshly. I'm going to be much more intentional about how I treat people and speak to people. I treat them with much more reverence and a sense of appreciation and a sense of gratitude. And I can't tell you how many people that I ran into in hospice when they died that would say, this is such a tremendous gift to me. This dying is such a tremendous gift. Now that's, you know, not everybody says that, but there was one part of them that of course didn't want to die. And if you had a choice, well, do you want to die? No, I don't want to die. But because I know I'm going to die, the intentionality of my wife, the preciousness to which I am actually appreciating everything, and there's an element here in terms of how much pain you're in and things like that, you know, but how much I'm able to just appreciate every moment now, moment to moment. So that's what, if we could do that throughout our life, with a sense that we're not going to be around forever. You know, if we really knew we were going to die next week, we would be treating our lives very, very differently. And so that's the sense. It brings much more of a sense of integrity, and in some ways some both intensity, but also relaxation, because we know we have to let go. Why hang on to it? You're going to have to give it up anyway. You know, it's like Suki Roshi, somebody asked Suki Roshi, just summarize Buddhism. Can you just put it together? It's pretty complicated. Just put it together in one sentence. And he said, impermanence. And it's true. In the Mahayana tradition, they say, what are the three main marks, that you penetrate in Buddhism? The first main mark is the doctrine of no self. And what does that mean? It doesn't mean, of course, I'm different from you. But it also means exactly what the Heart Sutra was saying. That we're always changing. We're always impermanent. And the more we see that and the potentiality of that, we're able to let go moment after moment. The more we deeply more incorporate that wisdom, that's what that means by, yes, we have a solid self, but we hold ourselves so much more lightly. We're just an ephemeral process. As the Lojong teaching says, see everything as a dream. See your life as a dream. And that isn't like wishy-washy, mushy. It means lighten up. That's what all these teachings are, to help you lighten up and let go. You know, see your life as a dream. Isn't that true? I mean, we were talking about this in the class the other day. You raise kids. Did I really raise those kids? Did I really put all that energy, all those driving to school for you? Did that really exist? We know that. We feel that that's true, right? Or we took a vacation, really, for me, a really intense vacation, you're doing something. Did I really do that? Did that really happen? And there's something beautiful about that. That kind of letting go and ephemeralness of the situation. So there's a tradition in Zen where teachers write death poems. And I thought maybe I'd read you a couple, if I can find them. Somewhere in here. Oh, here they are. So Rokyon, you know, who's sort of the most famous poet in Japan. He was a monk, and he sort of gave up being a monk and went up in the mountains and pretty much led a solitary life. But then he'd come down and he'd play with the kids, have a little wine, play with the kids. And so his death poem. Now it reveals its hidden side, and now the other. Thus it falls in an autumn leaf. I mean, there's something very accepting about that. His life, the autumn leaf. And each of the death poems reflect a character. There's no particular way it is. Here's one I kind of like this. I sort of like this. Life as we find it, death too. A parting poem, why insist? In other words, is it really that important, even the death poem? Are you going to insist that I even do this? I don't even want to give that up. You know, don't make this a ritual, you know. "76 years with this life. I've not caught heaven. Don't fear hell. I'll lay these bones beyond the triple world. Unenthralled, unperturbed. No mind." This is another one. "No mind, no Buddha. Disciples prattle." You know, like they're, "Don't die, don't die." "Disciples prattle. Got skin, got marrow. Well, goodbye to that." "Beyond peak glows on peak." "76 years piling sins. I leap into hell above life and death." There's lots of great stories where people, Zen teachers, actually call everybody together for the last Dharma talk. And then they say, "This will be my last Dharma talk. I'll be dying in 30 minutes right after the Dharma talk." Or, "This is my Dharma talk." And I sit down and I die. And there's actually lots of stories. And then there are other stories where everybody starts crying and the guy comes back again and says, "What is the deal? Didn't you guys get it?" And then, you know, and then he dies. Or who knows, do you know Mary Oliver's poem? You know, where it's really a sweet one, Buddha's last days, and it's going on Buddha's last days, and all the monks are crying and everything. And the last line is, "Didn't I tell you? What have I been teaching you for 40 years? I've been teaching you that everything, all conditioned things, are impermanent. That's what I've been teaching you. And here I am, I'm teaching it to you. You think I was going to be an exception to this?" You know? I added that last sentence, that exception. I'm elaborating on it. So I thought maybe I'd just talk practically for a minute about death and dying. We've been talking about the realm of the absolute. Let's talk practically, because I had a lot of experience. I ran a hospice program, and a lot of you here have had experience. So the main thing is, don't have your own agenda. If you're helping people, you could have your own agenda if you're dying. Your agenda should be to probably let go and try to be as calm as you can and do that for most of your life, so when you get to that point. It's kind of like Indians. They used to say Indians, from the time they were about 12, were trained to have a death chant. You ever hear that? So they would chant when they got in a difficult situation. You know, they saw the enemy coming over the hill or the grizzly through the woods. They'd have their death chant, you know, which could be, who knows, let go. May all beings, may the great spirit, whatever your death chant was, you'd have something to comfort you. But the idea was, from the time they were 12 or 13, because life was so short, and death could be so imminent, that they were always being prepared for it. They always had that death chant. They didn't wait till they were 78 before they started figuring out their death chant. They were living with death on their shoulder all the time. They didn't, you know, they didn't have this expectation. Wow, I'm 86 years old, you know, why do I have to die now? I mean, I've heard that a lot, you know. I'll probably be one of them that feels that way, you know. Just give me another 5 years. But, so, anyway. So keep yourself calm, you know, and don't have an agenda for the person if you're with them. They'll find out what they want, be receptive, and if you're with them, just try to keep your own mind as calm as you can. There'd be a lot of fear in the room. Try not to add your fear to the room. You can calm the situation down just by being calm yourself. If the person isn't conscious, just send them metta. Sit down and say, may you be peaceful and at ease. May all beings be peaceful and at ease. You know. And send that to them. Know that even people that are unconscious can also hear. You know that. Did you know that? That even people that are unconscious are aware when people are talking in the room. If they have some history and you know beforehand, that's why it's good to talk to people, like, you know, if I'm dying, yes, I'd like people to be in the room chanting the Metta Sutra and the Heart Sutra for me. And that traditionally is what you do in the Tibetan tradition, all Buddhist traditions. All Buddhist traditions are saying, death can be a great opportunity. This is an opportunity for release. That's what we're trying to do. That's what nirvana is release. So what can you, the atmosphere can you create to kind of help with the release? My mother, for some reason, who was a Catholic, you know, I'd read her some chapters out of the Bible. I was also reading her chapters from the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which this afternoon I'm going to read you a translation of Stephen Levine, who, by the way, has written some very good books, who dies in this book. He's thought deeply on this topic and has a lot of meditations, guided meditations that I'd recommend. Those books have been around for a long time. So you need to try to have a conversation with somebody. Once they die, I'm going to tell you what sort of the traditional Buddhist way to do it is. This doesn't mean you have to do it that way. You can do it any way you want that feels comfortable. Traditionally, usually people sit with the body for a while. For my sister, for example, her husband was freaked out by the idea of keeping the body around. So I had to acknowledge that. And so I would talk to her beforehand and ask her, I said, for me, would it be okay if you stayed around for, you know, 6 or 7 hours while I could chant? And she said yes, but I could tell it was uncomfortable for her husband. So I couldn't do a traditional. But traditionally, like Buddhists in this country, it's different in different places, depending on how hot it is. But it is usually 3 days. So 3 days is a long time. So, Bob, if somebody starts giving a message on that, could you go unplug it? Thank you. So usually when somebody, after they die, you usually walk. You can wash their body if you're comfortable with that. I've done that several times. You get herbs and create a little bath of herbs, and you can wash their body and clean their body. And then you usually dress them in clean clothes, and you clean the bed. And then you can bring flowers around. Sometimes if I can be a little graphic here, you plug the orifices up. But there are people that can do this for you. There's people that are trained to do this. I can do this, you know. And you lay people out. There's other ways you take care of them, which I won't go into right now. if you need information on this, you can always call me and I'll be happy to give it to you. And then you basically sit with the body. And usually after a day, you put some ice around them and change the ice to keep the body, and you have a lot of ventilation. And the beauty of doing this is that it really helps the family and friends grieve, because you begin to tangibly see the body change. And as the body changes, it becomes very obvious after 3 days that, and you've been there, you've been chanting, and it's time to let the body go. That has a very different feeling than somebody dying. The funeral service comes in, they zip them up in a black bag and take them off, 20 minutes later. Mm-hmm. It just feels so cold to me. But after 3 days, you're quite ready. But the real reason why the Buddhists do that is because we don't believe just because the heart stops that that's when death happens, that there's still spirit or life or vitality or energy. And you can see that. You can see the person's color start to change hour by hour, And that the life force is still ebbing out, and it takes a while to send that energy out. So that's the main reason why that process is done. Then the next step is usually you can go to the crematorium, and there can be a ceremony there too. When Walter Blum, if you remember, Walter was a member of our sangha for a while, and longtime Buddhist practitioner, and I was there when he died and officiated, and we went up to the crematorium. I think it's Pleasant Hill, and most crematoriums they're not set up for lots of people, but if you talk to them, they'll let you go in, and it's not like a church. It's most people don't go back there, but you can do that, and that can be a powerful part of the ceremony too. Usually members of the immediate family, and we chanted, put flowers on it, we set up a little altar, and it's something very powerful about seeing the body actually go in with the flames, and then the door shut, and we have this little altar here, and we're doing chanting, and I'm bowing, and I noticed that my sleeve caught fire. See this little patch right here? So I looked over, my sleeve was on fire. It was a flame was leaping up. And I went, oh. I said, well, Walter, I guess you want me to go with you. So, anyway. And then you receive the ashes. And then later, a month or 2 months or later, then you actually have a formal memorial service where the ashes are brought in. Person's picture, again, you chant, and we did this, if you remember, we did this for Walter. It's in the Zen tradition, the drums are going, and I had a flame, a circle of flame, where you actually, again, sending that energy off, and then members of the family actually address, like you're talking, Walter, and then you send him off. So that's kind of the tradition. And also, so the chant, you do the Heart Sutra, because again, the Heart Sutra is how to dispel fear. And the way you dispel fear is you see that all component things are ephemeral anyway, and you're sending them off. But there is one chant called the Daihi Shindarani, which I've never chanted with you in, because we don't chant in Japanese. I made a decision that I was going to keep it more American in our song and not do the Dai Shinrani, but I've been chanting this for 40 years, and you chant it every couple of days as the morning service, and when you're at Zen Center. And it was never translated. Like, we've translated, this is the only one that was never translated. And I'd say, how come it's not translated? And they'd say, well, because you can't really translate it. It wouldn't make any sense if we translated it. So I've never read a translation. When I was preparing for this, I thought, what the heck? 45 years. Let me just type in and see what comes up. And sure enough, a translation came up. And I thought, well, heck, I like this. I like this translation. This is exactly, it's the same as the Heart Sutra. It's Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, who has compassion for however you are in life, right? she'll receive you, right? Well, it turns out the Dai Shinrani is actually to Avalokiteshvara too, which I never knew. So here it is. And what I like about it is it clearly precedes Zen, goes way back into Indian Buddhism, and predates Indian Buddhism, because there's some figures in here like Indra, and there's mantras in here. And there's certain periods where mantras, like you probably didn't know, the Heart Sutra, the last couple lines, were actually a mantra. It was a very strong, mantras were considered to have things, you could make things happen with mantras. And you could make people, you could help the spirit of the deceased with, and this is what this is. A Dharani is a mantra. That's what a Dharani means. So I'm going to read you this. So here we are. We're sending somebody off, right? This is it. The drums are beating. The flame is going around. We're extinguishing this person, and we're saying, go into emptiness. Go into the void. Go into the ocean. We're sending them off. Adoration to the Triple Treasures. Adoration to Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the Mahasattva, who is the great compassionate one. Om to the one who performs a leap beyond all fears. Having adorned him or her, may I enter into the heart of the one known as the noble, adorable Avalokiteshvara. It means the completing of all meaning. It is pure. It is that which makes all beings victorious and cleanses the path of existence. Thus, Om, the seer, the world transcending one, Om Hari, the Mahasattva, all, defilement, the earth, it is the heart. Do the work. Hold fast, O great victor. Hold on, I hold on to Indra the Creator. Move, my defilement free seal. Come, here. A joy springs up in me. Speak, directing. Hulu, mala, hulu, heli, sara, siri, sulu. Be awakened, have awakened, O merciful one, O daring ones, to the joyous hail, to the successful one hail, the great successful one hail, to the one who has attained mystery in the disciplined hail. Adoration to the Triple Treasures, adoration to Avalokiteshvara, hail. May these prayers be successful to this magical formula. Hail. I think we've been missing out chanting this thing in Japanese. Hi, this is great. I mean, you just want to, you know, it's like, you know, don't you like those movies where the Vikings shove the boat out, you know, with a body, and then they shoot arrows in the flame, you know, what a great way to send somebody off, you know. Anyway. This is great stuff. So let me end with a quote with Suzuki Roshi again. How do we abide in the absolute? The more we abide in the absolute, the easier it is to let go into it. The metaphor I always like is if you're a wave going to the shore, and your identity is the wave, and you really want to hang on to being a wave. You know, I kind of like myself. I'm 6 feet, you know. I have a nice crest. A lot of water behind me. You're going into the beach. You have a lot of fear. You're going to hit the beach, right? But if you can identify with the fact that you're going to be the ocean, that you're really the ocean, then there's a lot less fear about letting this particular incarnation go. For Zen students, the most important thing is not to be dualistic. Our original mind includes everything within itself. It is always rich and sufficient within itself. You should not lose your self-sufficient state of mind. This does not mean a closed mind, but actually an empty mind with a ready mind. If your mind is empty, it is always ready for anything. It is open to everything. It is a beginner's mind. There are many possibilities. In the expert mind, there is few. If you discriminate too much, you limit yourself. If you are too demanding or too gritty, your mind is not rich and self-sufficient. If we lose our original self-sufficient mind, we will lose all the precepts, right? Because then we get greedy and we want to lie, steal, and hurt people. When your mind becomes demanding, when you long for something, you will end up violating your own precepts. Not to tell lies, not to steal, not to kill, not to be immoral, and so forth. If you keep your original mind, the precepts will keep themselves. In the beginner's mind, there is no thought. I have obtained something. All self-centered thoughts limit our vast mind. When we have no thought of achievement, no thought of self, we are true beginners. Then we can really learn something. The beginner's mind is the mind of compassion. When our mind is compassionate, it is boundless. Dogen Zenji, the founder of our school, always emphasized how important it is to resume our boundless original mind. Then we are always true to ourselves, in sympathy with all beings, and can actually practice. So the most difficult thing is always to keep your beginning mind. There is no need to have a deep understanding of Zen. Even though you read much Zen literature, you must read each sentence with a fresh mind. You should not say, "I know what Zen is," or "I have attained enlightenment." This is also the real secret of the arts. Always be the beginner. Be very, very careful about this point. If you start to practice Zazen, you will begin to appreciate your beginner's mind. Open, expansive mind, ready for the next adventure. Let's chant the precepts.
Beings are numberless. I bow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. The Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.